Like, it scares me that orange juice can be in a brown cardboard box in a closet somewhere and then come out from that gun into my glass. I don't want to live in a world where my mimosas got hot orange drink in it.
Hey, my name is Billy Depp, and I'm a restaurateur obsessed with what it takes to create the most memorable meals ever. Having come up working almost every position in the business, I've seen how there are usually hundreds of details that need to be orchestrated perfectly to satisfy the highest of expectations among all those that food brings together. This mix in chemistry, or lack thereof, makes for mind-blowing storytelling about more than just what's on the plate. So in each episode, with a unique and unforgettable guest, we will discuss the power of food, the importance of coming together for meals, and unravel, explore, and discover a life-changing dining experience that has forever impacted lives. This is the Meal of Your Life podcast. My next guest has been called the world's best bartender, winning mixology awards all over the world, making cocktails on the red carpet of the Oscars and in some of the best bars. I'm incredibly jealous. His name is Charles Joly. He's a super cool dude, and I'm really excited to talk to him because I've always felt like the beverage game has been underestimated when trying to deliver elevated meal experiences. So we dive deep into the good, bad, and ugly from the beverage cocktail perspective, whether in global mixology competitions or restaurants or in your own home. And we do so all from my podcast booth in the middle of the National Restaurant Show. So you'll hear a lot of the hustle and bustle because it's the largest, longest running food and now bar show in the world. And that action and activity sounds just like a restaurant and bar. So it's perfect. Hope you enjoy.
As you can appreciate from your long history in the business as well, my first bar job ever was at the original Crowbar on Kingsbury.
No way.
Old school. I mean, late 90s when it was at its height, the height of the rave era.
I'm cut from the same cloth. Yeah. My first job in the nightlife world was as a doorman at Shelter.
Yeah.
So and those were kind of...
I used to sneak into Shelter with my buddy's ID, who had a strong 13-letter Polish last name from the south side.
You're outing me right now that I failed at my job at the front door.
No, we look a lot alike. We look a lot alike. Yeah. Drink responsibly and don't drink underage, of course. But Shelter was amazing, and it was during that era, and it was a special time. And, man, I learned all the skills that it takes as a bartender, though. We would do 2,000 people through that warehouse a night, and I was a bar back only. I didn't get to touch booze for 3 years. And never bartended at Crowbar. I was a barback and eventually head barback there. But you learn how to deal with adverse situations, work in crazy environments, carry 3 cases of beer through a dance floor. Very different era in the scene. VIP room was like 4% of the bar, and the dance floor was 60% of the bar. You went there and worshiped the DJ. They probably sold more Gatorade than whiskey, I'd say. But
really? That's right.
That was the time and place. But we've come a long way since then.
I did a martial art movie once where I had a fight scene in Crowbar. And I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. I got to like live the fantasy or the nightmare that you never want to see in a nightlife environment where a full martial art fight broke out in Crowbar.
It was a fun time, man.
Wasn't it?
Was
it was
time.
Like
was
the heyday. And then you'd go back to Shelter and you go to the Crowbar and you'd all these different places. It was kind of like our Studio 54.
It really was. It was, it was not about flaunting money at all. It was about just going and like the weirder you were, the like more likely you were to get in quicker. It
and
was
I actually
great.
Don't remember the cocktailing at all. Like when I remember the environment. I think that is critical to all memories. When you're talking about the meal of your life, or you're talking about the hospitality or even entertainment experience of your life, or one that matters most. One thing we were talking about yesterday when we were on stage doing the Star of the Bar competition, you were a judge, I was the MC, was about cultures around the world and how the bartending cocktail making scene is exploding across the world. Tell me what you've seen, because you've been traveling a ton, doing these competitions and speaking engagements.
Yeah, I've been super fortunate in the last several years to travel all over the place. In 2014, won this global bartending competition. That's really like the largest, most prestigious, like bartending, not just cocktails. It's really about the total deal of being a bartender.
And what's it called?
World Class, for Diageo World Class. And so there's like 50 plus countries involved. It's like the Olympics. You kind of you earn the right to represent your country through various regionals, and then you represent your country, and then all of the country winners get together in a different global location each year. We were in the UK my year, Scotland and London, and 5 days of everything from classic cocktails to food pairing to speed, efficiency to being able to think on your feet to, like, you know, working with modern techniques, just everything. And more importantly, it was the unspoken skills that we get in the industry of being able to deal with adverse situations quickly, not breaking. No matter how things are chaotic behind the curtain, we never let them see up front, you know? Like, and you know, I mean, look at even just like the NRA here. This is an incredible, massive undertaking, and that probably is already planning for next year. And no one sees behind the curtain about all of the moving parts and people that make something like this happen. The same as even in a small bar or neighborhood restaurant. You don't know what's going on in the kitchen, and you don't need to know that, you know, a line cook showed up hungover or cut his pinky off on accident. Everything's going to be okay. Food's still going to get out. You know, we don't run out screaming and crying into the alley much. And
so it was chaotic at that competition for you?
It was as much about mental preparedness and stability as anything, being able to keep your head on straight, truly. But is, you know, of course you need to make great cocktails, but it's about, why do we go to bars to begin with? It's not just the booze. You can make a drink at home. You can get a great recipe for a Manhattan at home. It's about the bartenders. It's about the environment. It's about connecting with your friends. It's about the music, the lighting, the sound. It's about impacting all of your, it's experiential. And that's what people are starting to figure out.
For a guy that's seen as a cocktail expert around the world, it's interesting to hear how much weight you're putting towards everything outside of the liquid.
It's gotta
you're
be.
Talking about.
The liquid's the easiest part. We can learn right now. Like, I can teach you to make 10 perfect classic cocktails as well as damn near any bar in the city right now. You know, like 3-4 ingredient drinks. They're recipes. That's a craft. Executing it consistently and in speed is a skill. But it's hospitality is where it becomes more freeform, more malleable, where that's where the touch comes on. Think about music, a classical piece. Like, some people play it, or jazz or something, and it has soul, it has feeling. Some people can play it and hit all the exact same notes, and it doesn't get in your chest the same way. You can be brought to tears by a good piece of music, yeah, if it's played with, like, soul and love. I think the same thing with a great hospitality experience.
So when you were in that competition, what was the pain point? What was the euphoric, like, win? How did it all play out towards the height of it all?
Really a tremendously difficult week. There's, you know, our business, man, it's like the camaraderie is pretty amazing. Nobody's cutthroat in it. We're all helping one another. If somebody needed a bar tool or had a question, we're willing to help. Nobody's sabotaging anybody's simple syrup with salt or anything, you know. By the last challenge, we got whittled down from whatever, 55, 60 people to 5 of us. That was easy. I was like, well, it's like all on the table now. We've done everything we can do. At that point, there's a speed and efficiency round that I won at the end of it. They tell you who wins each round. I won that round, and the Americans had traditionally done well in it because of the way we bartend, and I 100% credit being able to work intelligently and quickly to my nightclub days.
You just pulled away. I mean, you just...
Yeah.
You won.
I guess so. They don't show you the final points. I think at that point I was comfortable and relaxed, and as I was saying, it's not like in that competition, the reason I love a world-class competition, it's not a cocktail competition. It's not just being judged on liquid in the glass. As we had just talked about, your guests don't just come in and say, did I have a good time at Sunda or whatever it might be. Yeah. Well, the drinks were great, and so that was everything. No, they're going to talk about, like, my server was awesome, the music was on point, wow, the room was designed so beautifully. It's everything, and it's a very tactile situation. I think if you look at any... Like, when I walk in, and I bet you as an operator and just someone who loves to go out feels the same. The first thing when I walk into a new bar or restaurant, light, sound, temperature. Like,
me
those
too.
Three things are the most, they can make or break. They decide how long I'm going to stay before I've ever ordered a drink, how much I like the place, my impression.
You know what? What you're saying is so critical. It is exactly light, sound, temperature. It might sound silly because they're probably thinking they entertain in their homes and that's not usually a thing, but light, sound, temperature for a hospitality venue and sort of the environment for the experience isn't always really at the forefront of manager training. It isn't at the forefront of what is paid attention to by even operators, even some of the best operators.
Yeah. It's because those things are almost subconscious. We're talking about the roots of our senses, right? Touch, taste, sound, smell. We're so in tune with these things. We don't think about hearing while we're hearing. You can't turn your hearing off. If you plug your ears, it just gets louder. You know what I mean? It's like if you're chewing something, it actually amplifies it. You can't fully block it out. And you don't realize that you're feeling them. So yeah, you need to consciously, as a great manager, walk into the room. I always encourage managers, bartenders, to pop out from behind the bar and sit at their own bar where a guest would sit and look at their bar. And it's
so funny, I encourage
them
to go out on the street and act like you're getting out of a cab.
Ah, great. I like it. You're 2 steps further.
Yep. Well, because you first see the glass on the door. Yep. Or does it have fingerprints? Is there a wrapper on the ground?
It's unbelievable. You will come up with for anybody that's in hospitality, do that that before your shift. And even if you are very diligent and detail-oriented, you're going to have a list. Bring a pad and pen with you, and you're going to have a list of things that, right, fingerprints on the door, that one light's out on the street, the carpet didn't get changed out before you even walk in. And then you'll just see so many things as the details.
And what we're talking about really is that these things matter to the overall experience. They create the value at which you or your guests make a determination forever and then talk about it.
People don't consciously go into a place looking to pick it apart, but as humans, we're super adept at picking out differences when something's out of place. When everything's perfect, we're not like, wow, like that mirror, like somebody polished the hell out of it. You just know that everything in the room feels right. But when something's out of place, you start to notice it and it starts to fall apart. I've been in venues where I've been like, oh, wow, like, why are the doors on the back bar all falling off? That's strange. And like, oh, that mirror's broken. And then you just start and it snowballs.
Yeah.
And then, God forbid, you walk in the bathroom and you see what's going on. You're like, oh. And then it goes back to that old age-old thing of what's going on in the bathrooms publicly. It makes you wonder what's going on in the kitchens. And then it's just downhill. And at that same place, I ended up ordering whiskey on ice, and they gave me crushed ice with 2 ounces of really nice whiskey. And I was like, again, not bougie, but you've just turned you gave me a whiskey snow cone, which on a hot day sounds fantastic, or maybe like a mint julep, but not exactly what I was looking for at that moment.
Let's get back to the things that you're noticing around the world.
Yeah, I liked example. I was in Israel, in Tel Aviv, which is an incredible party city. It's absolutely off the hook. Like no other, beautiful. You're in the Mediterranean. It's gorgeous. That whole coastline is brilliant. But then we drive up to Jerusalem, and there's a cocktail scene there, and outlying cities. There's straight up proper cocktail bars, as good of a cocktail as you'll get anywhere in the world. You go to Indonesia, which is maybe it's a long, far, far destination to go to, and Jakarta is like one of the most populous cities on the planet. They've got a great cocktail scene. But then you can go to the resort city of Bali, and there's speakeasies tucked away that are done right. There's 2,000 person resorts that have chef tasting menus and cocktail bars on the beach.
Are their cocktails different because of their access to certain natural resources that are just so lush and beautiful? And
so what happens in every market is, as a cocktail scene starts, they start to emulate the very classic old school vibe that what is perceived as the speakeasy vibe that was born in London and New York, a dozen years or more ago. And that's great. And you do need to learn your classics, but it's not even real a great representation of Prohibition at all. That's a very romanticized era. But regardless, that's where they start. And it's not a bad place to start. Or they start in great restaurants. We'll just start to develop programs. And then they realize, oh, wait, we don't need to just emulate this exact same thing. And they start to eventually, years down the line, get back to their roots, use the local ingredients. That's what I love to see. It's like, yeah, if I'm in Indonesia, like, awesome. I can get a Manhattan anywhere on the planet. I want, like, your local produce. Like, what's growing here that I can only get here? What crazy fruits? If I'm in Peru, there's stuff coming out of the rainforest that doesn't make it any further than Lima, and so you're seeing all these amazing fruits and vegetables and ingredients work their way into cocktails. And it's just like, it takes time for us to take pride in our own countries. We rebel against kind of what our grandparents drank for a minute. Think about where bourbon was 15 years ago, and now it's the by far the most It's wildly popular globally, but in the U.S., you've got 20-somethings, men, women, everybody's drinking bourbon, they're all about it. 20 years ago, that wasn't the vibe at all. It was like kind of like your granddad's drink. And, look at the cocktail movement, look at Mad Men, whatever it is. I'm glad that it's that way, but we're embracing things. In Mexico, I travel to Mexico all the time. If you wanted to drink well, if you wanted to show that you were drinking and were a knowledgeable drinker, you would drink single malt scotch or an old, like a Chivas 25 or something, like some, an old, heavily aged, really beautiful scotch. And that showed that you had some money in your pocket. It showed that you knew better. Now, Mexico's like, you know what? We make some of the most amazing spirits in the world right here. We have mezcal. We have incredible 100% agave tequila. And the next generation, the 20-somethings now, are embracing that. And you're seeing tequila and mezcal bars pop up all over Mexico, where, ironically, that shit didn't exist 20 years ago.
Is there, a particular trend that you're seeing internationally in the either process of making cocktails or the ingredients or spirits or components?
Trends tie on a little bit quicker because of the globalization, the internet. You can pop on YouTube, somebody's. So there are things. How do I put this nicely? I get mad at media a little bit about trends, because trends, when people ride them too hard, drives things into the ground, perfectly good movements, and it sets false goals for operators to chase trends. Then you see everybody smoking cocktails, so we need to start smoking cocktails. I designed and built a box specifically to smoke cocktails that we sell, and I think it's a great tool to use, and I think smoked cocktails are fantastic if you do them right. But you have to walk before you run, and so sometimes what I would like to see less of is people feeling pressured to be all things to all people and overdoing it. It's like, figure out what you want to do, focus on it, figure out what you love, figure out what your guests want, figure out what you want to be known for, and dial in and do that. I would say stay true to yourself and don't worry too much about trends in terms of it. But I think the trend is, the biggest trend is about giving the same attention to beverage as you do to food on your plate, having the same expectation for liquid in your glass that you do for food on your plate. And that is not just be a trend, that should be a mantra. And you work hard for your money, and what you are imbibing, you should care about,
You have all this great advice, and you're influencing people all around the world. And you were actually a mentor to my business partner, Brandon Phillips, and it was very cool of you to be behind the bar at Odomezzo, our spot over the James Beard Awards. Who are some of your mentors?
Yeah, I will say, Brandon's a dear friend. So, I definitely did not get here alone, but I was fortunate to get in on damn near the ground floor. So they're some of the old guard are now my people that I would consider my mentors, whether they know it or not. Tony Abu Ghanim was judging yesterday with us out of Vegas. He's certainly, whether he likes it or not, been super influential. One woman, though, that was definitely that I am the off of her family tree is Bridget Albert, who is an educator here in Illinois. She worked with Tony in Vegas, came out here. She started working with the United States Bartenders Guild and one of the big distributors. United States Bartenders Guild is an amazing nonprofit organization that's 60 chapters in the country that bartenders can get involved with wherever they are. It's a great way to meet like-minded people and to help if you're wondering how to get started. It's a great thing to look into. I remember the moment she made me a whiskey sour. It was the first time I had had a really lovingly made drink with fresh lemon juice and an egg white and, the bitters caringly put on top. I'm talking about a simple 4-ingredient drink. I'd served so many whiskey sours over the years to guests, and they had been fine. And people loved them, and everybody tipped and came back for more. But this one, it's like I took a sip, and the light bulb went off, and it was a moment of, what the hell have I been drinking all of this time? She ran this thing called the Academy of Spirits and Fine Service, which is part of one of the distributors as well. And I did that course with her. It's kind of like Bartending 101. And I think they went through 45 academies. It's totally nonprofit, $100 to join, the thing. It was, it cost nothing. Do not go to bartending school. I don't know a single bartender that has ever gotten a bartending job through traditional bartending school. It's a nightmare that those things still exist. It's a scary thing. But anyways, you know, there are organizations out there. But she was the one. She gave it to me. Anyways. Who made you your first great drink? Do you remember the like first time you had a cocktail? Not, you know, we say a proper cocktail, a cocktail made with love. You know, like one that was like, oh, somebody puts a, like, doesn't mean it took 7 minutes. Like, and they shouldn't take 7 minutes. If a cocktail takes 7 minutes to make, something's going wrong, or your bartender needs to get his shit in gear, or she. Cocktail.
I think the first time that I started discovering cocktails at a higher level was when I crossed over from doing nightclubs to restaurants. And I knew that the meal experience, I just had, all of a sudden was exposed to so many layers of depth with chefs that began to care more about the wine and the beer and the complexity and vast array of opportunity to explore in that area. And then they sort of exposed me to cocktails. And I was doing a research and development trip in New York. And I just noticed, not through bars, not through cocktail bars, just through dinner experiences.
That's
with,
where they start in every city, before cocktail bars emerge.
Yeah.
Because you have a captive audience of people who want to eat well. It's the safest way to launch a cocktail program is in a great restaurant.
And I think access to fresh herbs and fruit.
Staff that gets it as well. They're a little bit better trained.
Sea salts and different types of training process where it's open to a larger investment in the hospitality experience, and then realizing that they're part of an orchestration of all sorts of roles and inputs to create one meal experience, you know. And I think that's where I caught it.
Yeah, and that's it. If I'm going to talk to a bar restaurant owner, like, and they want to talk about a beverage, you know, like trying to get some cocktails going, the first thing I'm going to do is look at their food menu and walk in the food cooler, and see what's there. Because from a business sense, of course, like, let's cross-utilize some things. From a flavor component sense, like, the food and cocktails should go together. You shouldn't have your food changing seasonally, and then I'm getting blueberry mojitos in October. Something's wrong.
Right.
And I see it all the time, you know, still at certain, yeah, certain joints. And it's just like, well, yeah, put the same, like, it's, we like to drink. I don't know about you, man. When I go out, my liquid portion of my tab when I go out to dine is equal, if not double, my food portion. Because I can drink a hell of a lot more than I can eat. I can only have one entree or three small plates or whatever, you know, whatever it is. But I can have a drink to start. I can have some champagne. I can have a cocktail with my main course. I can have a little digestif afterwards. It's like, it's a good business for operators, and it's a good experience for the guests.
Speaking of meal experiences, is there a particular meal experience that you remember that stands out in your mind that might have affected the way in which you sort of projected yourself going forward, or anything that...
Man, it's moments, you know? I think something as simple, one of my most memorable food experiences was my first time in Paris. And I was with my girlfriend at the time, and we had gone out to a bunch of bars and restaurants, but that night we were just like walking past a bakery. We went in and grabbed like some fresh baked bread, went into a store and got some meat and cheese, literally bought the wine and had to buy a corkscrew, and just went and sat down by the river underneath, overlooking, or looking up at Notre Dame Cathedral, and the moonlight was coming through, and there's some kids drinking wine from the bottle, like giggling, you know, up the bridge. And to me, like, it was bread, meat, and cheese, like, you know, in that moment with some cheap French wine and great company. And it was one of the most memorable bites of my life, like, just like hanging out and doing that. Because, again, time and place, right? It's not just about the liquid. It's not just about the actual food. It was amazing bread and amazing cheese and amazing meats that we had.
Three simple ingredients.
Yeah, exactly. But it was a time and a place and environment. And it was a beautiful, you know, spring night, and the lighting was great, and the sounds were that of Paris. It was little laughing teenagers, you know, doing stuff they shouldn't be, and, you know, cars whizzing by above head. But it was, at that moment, the best restaurant on the planet.
And it was the lighting, sound, and temperature.
Yeah, exactly. How it comes back to that, right? With some good food, like decent food, but nothing, nobody sous vide any of it. You know? I would say one of the most memorable meals that is actually a composed meal, if I can ramble a little bit. We're in Oaxaca in southern Mexico. It's like literally as Mexico tapers off into and there's some amazing surfing down there, literally to the very southern tip of Mexico. And it turns into a very different Mexico. It's one of the most diverse landscapes. It goes in 30 minutes drive. You can go from pine forests to arid desert to the craziest high mountains. And it's so remote in some of those areas that many of the villages, they're indigenous Mexicans. They don't even speak Spanish in some of those areas. They speak Zapotec, and they speak just, they're literally Mexican Indians. They're original. The Spaniards didn't get into those parts as much. So you still have this very authentic feel. And that is where some of the best mezcals come from. It's a very hot category right now. And when it's done in its best, most authentic way, it's one of my favorite spirits. We went down with Del Maguey Mezcal, which is all of these, they call single villages, because each bottling comes from a different palenque or distillery. And I use the term distillery so loosely, because you go to a distillery, like an amazing established distillery, and they're, you know, you're wearing hard hats and beard covers, you know, and you're walking on yellow lines, and there's OSHA, there's beautiful stainless, you know, equipment and whatnot. These are open air. Rarely there's even buildings, corrugated tin roofs. The one we went to was just literally tree trunks holding up corrugated tin roofs. There's a radio plane powered by a car battery. The river was running by it, and that's where the water came from. Open air fermentation, wood-fired stills. It's just, that's rustic, man, and it's delicious. And so we're at one of these palenques, and they had us for lunch. The wife of one of the palenqueros, the distillers, made us this mole. Sacrificed one of their goats for the meal. And I say sacrifice not in a religious way, although it is something of a religious experience. When you're in that remote of an area, it's not like a chicken. Okay, that's a daily food maybe. But a goat, that's livestock. That's something you would do for a wedding or for a major anniversary or something.
Yeah. It's like, a provider. I mean, it's not just for that meat at that moment. It's a lifetime of...
You're an honored guest at that point. That's large livestock. So we knew, like, wow, this was like they'd really... stretch themselves. There's no store. You can't roll down to the store. You're in the middle of nowhere in southern Mexico. Literally, it can take hours to get to the major city of Oaxaca, where you're at. And this mole she made. I mean, there was. I'm a vegetarian now, but at the time, I loved. Actually, if I went back right now, I would eat that mole. I would have three plates of it with the goat and with chicken and everything else. I would absolutely break my vegetarianism for something made with that much love. Like that as a dish, as the food on the dish, was mind-blowing. Like, just spiced perfectly. The meat was, like, amazing. I mean, just, there was a tree stump in the dirt. The floors were not even tiled or anything. The dirt from the outside rolled to the inside of the table we were sitting at. And there were still little droplets of where one of the chickens had been sent to his maker. Still in the dirt, as you've seen. I mean, that is, you know, of course the tortillas were fresh because, again, how the hell else would you make them? Why would you buy tortillas?
Right.
And that, you know, you have the option. So it's just, so that's a mind-blowing food, and mix it with some beautiful mezcal straight off the still. And woo.
All right, now I'm totally thirsty. My thanks to Charles. You can catch him at Charles Jolie, 1L and Jolie. Also look up Craft House Cocktails. It's his cocktail bottled beverage line, which is super exciting. And if you've seen my post, thank you. I just posted that podcastchart.com rated us like ahead of Martha Stewart's food podcast. What? That's crazy. That's all you guys. Thank you so much for following this and subscribing. I hope you guys had a chance to rate and review. You obviously must have, because that's kind of how I guess these charts, you know, find us and rate us. So thank you so much, and keep spreading the word, because who knows what we can do. I want to keep working harder with all these amazing reviews and these 5-star ratings and kind words, and I just really appreciate it. I'm shocked. I'm gonna keep going, so thank you. Spread the word. It's gonna happen. I think this is real. I'm committed. So yes, subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you so much. If you are doing so, you know what? Email me, b at rocketranch.com, rocketranch.com. I'd like to send you a gift. You are awesome. Thank you so much. Catch you next week.